Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
analog to digital conversion, A2D or ADC, depends where you're at. And the reason we're talking about this is that this is the hub, the interface which has allowed our digital age to flourish. Now, the thing about digital is that you have digital computer and digital data storage, but you have to actually convert the information on the outside world, which is generally found in an analog signal, into a digital form. That's a digitizer. So that's measure something, take a measurement, and produce a digital number out of it. To be truthful, there's been trying to actually say what the deep problem is. So I'm going to explain how this is done. But at the back of me, the voice is saying, we don't need to know, we don't want to know, and we never tell anybody. And I think this is the truth, that in Australian schools, in Australia, people never get told. And there's this story, if you why don't you tell about them? And they will come up with instantly three or four reasons why they don't need to, the kids nowadays don't need to know that, it's obvious, or thing. And at the end of it, they say, well, I don't know myself. And so it's not that they have a reason for not doing it, but they don't have the capability of knowing it. They haven't ever seen it. Now, that's one aspect. Or they say, well, I can explain about analog stuff, an analog thermometer, an analog this, analog voltmeter. You know, I can the coil. I can write about it. We can all do it. And this is very simple. That input creates a linear proportion. The linear proportion is all proportional. I can see it's all very easy. So I'm going to combine what I teach to this. So there's sort of like the tyranny of the analog. There's tyranny of not knowing the slightly complex way forward, how it's digitized. Therefore, you can't. You have a bias. You have an ignorance bias. That is, this is a lot of people are ignorant that they are ignorant, but these people secretly know they're ignorant, and therefore don't go on. So there's sort of a bias of not doing it, and then because I only explain analog things, I don't have no need to it. There is no need. It's sort of these circular arguments. Now, that being said, there's this sort of, well, it better be very easy so I can understand it. Now, the problem is that we've only done analog relatively recently. I'd say analog wasn't in the 60s, began in the 70s, and it's a recent phenomena, and it is anything but a amazing feat of engineering on many, many ways, equivalent almost to the moon landing. But in every digital thermometer, in every digital thing you have, there's these A to D's, and it's these fantastic things, and it is worthwhile discussing them, but it's not an easy thing. I have to say, I have to warn you that it's not an easy thing. Where I've come across it is that I've said, plop, okay, here's the real world, here's class, here's a stepping stone to put in, and the stepping stone has digitization in it. Why? Because looking inwards, that it's going to be better, the student's going to be better, or there's an education theory for it, or so. It's because that's what happens in the real world. So let's put it up there. And going through, it is basically, if you made a chasm, and I'm building this a bridge across. And first I've made a little wooden bridge, a little rope bridge, and a wooden bridge, and now I'm building the full bridge with the full case-by-case explanation. And I'm telling you as it is. So digital conceptually is not that easy. So for digital, you have to imagine a whole room, an office room of people who take something out and produce a number at the end. And that whole office room has been automated and then shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. Now, as an example, there was a valve digitizer I saw in Adelaide in 1987 from the 70s. And this digitizer was the size of, I suppose, two slabs of beer. A fairly big thing, a bigger thing, and it basically took in a voltage and spat out, just did its thing, and stuck out a digital thing at ones and zeros. So it measured, it was a digital measurer. And yeah, we have that box, what's happened in that box has not got simpler. In fact, we've just taken the same architecture and we've made it smaller, 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 till it's now vanishingly small. These are, when we're talking not millions of atoms across, this is a spot. And so it is an incredible piece of technology. And it's sort of like, basically, do we want to be domesticated, do we want to be captured, or do we want to be masters of our world? And if you've got a pet kitten in a house, you will lock the door to it, and that cat will basically starve because it will not know how to open the door. It's just, it doesn't have the opposable thumb. And basically, really what I'm talking now is basically giving students the opposable thumb of how things works. So the first things, now what's happened is that I've begun building this bridge across the chasm, starting to explain the bits and pieces for it. And I'm actually doing the easy part of a night walk at the moment. It's down to pass Australia's oldest bridge and most beautiful unused bridge. It might be the two bridges I'm going across. This is what I'm walking to at the moment, so you might hear the occasional thump and walk and stuff like that. Hopefully I'm speaking okay. Now let's get to it. So I'm writing this, and therefore I'm saying, okay, well, we have to throw caution to the wind and actually push and start to build explanations in. This reminds me of throwing caution to the wind. That is, when a system decides not to educate someone, but instead give false education, fake education, that is, too complicated, here's a simple example, and we're just not going to do it. But however, the complex example is 100% of what you're going to involve, but we're going to tell you about something else because it makes us feel comfortable. It's sort of throwing caution to the wind, but it's also taking a risk. And the great thing is, it's a risk that the teacher and the system doesn't take. It's a risk that you then put in to your future generation of people who are going to be out there competing against other countries, against other people who will be told. And those people, really, there's a sort of duty of care for it. So there's these weird lights up the top of this canyon I'm looking at. Sorry, I stopped talking about it at the moment. So really, you've got to go through there. Now, initially, what happens is that you have a sense of something in the environment that you want to know information about. And what used to happen is that although I couldn't, that sensor would have a property which I could see, which was proportional to it, an analog signal. So a thermometer, the current, mercury would rise to a certain thing, or a resistor, the temperature, the resistance would increase with the temperature a bit. So I'd be able to measure, but if I had doubled the temperature, the height would move, or the resistance would change. If I doubled it and a bit, it would double and a bit. The response would double and a bit. So that's the response, and that would be okay. Now, the problem with that is that message in electrical form is very fragile. So if I have a something and I measure it to 1 degree or something like that, I've measured something 100 to 1 degree, I then only require a 1% variation in the output, which would mask the signal. So, for instance, say I've got a long cable, and your cable, believe it or not, if you flex it, voltages will appear on it, because the plastic's got is piezoelectric. There's voltages, statics across it. Basically, if I switch on a piece of information, a voltage will appear, and so I will start to get noise. And so, in effect, I can hear the tiniest pitch or the loudest pitch. It will be proportional, but there's a lot of wind noise, like howling noise around it. So it's quite difficult to go. Now, what I can do is what people always used to do is say, "Oh, if it's small, it's going to be analog." We'll put it up on something called a preamplifier. And look, in my 80s days, preamplifiers were everything. Every detector had a preamplifier that would take the weak signal and amplify the buggery out of it to come across, and then you'd have all this noise signal. Now, the great thing about a digital signal is that there's a lot of digital noise. There can be digital noise there, but what happens if the thing is that you say 32 and you go 365, that can't be wrong, and then you get you can muck it up, but it's very hard to muck it up, and then you can keep on repeating it. The problem is perhaps that an analog signal is fine. It's on 100% of the time. A digital signal is, I have a 65, and you shout the orders. So it's like from a restaurant floor, you just shout them. So you shout the meal numbers across. But you can only shout it at a certain rate. Now, fortunately, that rate is blindingly fast, but it's not the same rate as analog signal. So analog's got some aspects to it, but it's incredibly noisy. The digital is pure, and it can actually go a long distance and degrade. So you can get 10% degradation in your signal, and it can be boosted again, but it's not going to be... it's not... The shape of the one is going to change, perhaps a bit. The size of the one is to change, but it'll still going to be recognisable as a one. Sort of like a shouting a kitchen order down the place. It's still going to be a one, as opposed to actually putting your soup in a pipe and actually pumping the soup across. So we have to do this process of digitization. That's the reason you want to digitize it. And there's a few more things on it in terms of that. Now, previously, if you've got a wanted to listen to everybody's conversation, you'd have to have an individual pipe to every conversation. Digitize, you can say, Sam, ham sandwich. Greg, leg of chicken. Susan, scrambled eggs. Elizabeth, curry sausages. And in the analog thing, you'd only just hear egg, curry sausages. Well, it doesn't make sense. But you can actually start to add information to it. Or you can say, small signal off, magnify this by 1,000, here it is. And you can start passing information up and down your wire, much more than just the signal. So the information comes across here. So you want to digitize it. Now, essentially what the digital thing is, it sits on your sensor, looks at the sensor, and rather than putting up a voltage, it puts a digital number proportional to the voltage. So, now as I said before, in the long gone past, it had to be a larger box did this. Now, so there are several steps. Now, firstly, your digital signal, your analog signal, is fluttering around the place like that, and you say, for goodness, stand still. And you basically take a snapshot of it and you work off that snapshot while the digital signal is doing whatever it is. You have a bit of pause. In that pause, you can start to do your business. Now, so you take a photograph of your analog signal that you want to digitize. You take a photograph and you digitize that photograph. So it's just a subtle point. You don't digitize your analog signal directly. You take a image of it, and it's called a sample and hold. S/H is the symbol for sample and hold, or SAH, sample. If we can sometimes do that, sample and hold. And this is a fundamental piece of circuitry, and basically it's basically an amplifier which tries to has a feedback loop on it. There you go, feedback loop on it, such that its output is fed to its input, such that there's no difference in one mode. That's the sample. The hold mode is stop, and it's going, what the fuck? It's, oh shit, that's so rude. What the fuck? And so it may be going, oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, 11, hey, the last thing I heard was 4. Okay, we're going to digitize 4. So that's the sample and hold. So the sample and hold signal is what is fed to something called a comparator. And then the next thing you have to understand is that what is held is in your A to D is a tiny, tiny piece of memory. And we have to unpack what memory is. So a memory, the time for a single block of memory, which says a single number, is called a register. And a register will be made out of, in some cases, in this case, 16 bits or, you know, 4 bits or whatever bits. It's the number of bits. It's a register is like a piece of paper, which you can put markings on. You can, or you can imagine a bank of switches and you switch them on or off. So that's a register. And with a piece of paper, there's actually 3 operations that you can do. You can write on the piece of paper, you can read what's written on the piece of paper, and then you can basically write zeros. You can erase as a sort of writing from it. I've got this bloody car coming up here. You can hear it coming from miles around the place. So I just crossed this bridge. I have to get off here. I'm going to point the microphone at it so you can actually hear it coming along. See me, and from you, old arm patrolling, having one eye closed so you don't lose your night vision. This register can have its individual things written, and its individual switch is written one switch at a time, or it can be read. Now, initially, it's a completely internal affair. You start off saying, clear the register, and then I'm going to write the most significant bit, and then I'm just going to read my register, and once I've read my register, I'm going to put what I've read into a digital to analog converter. Yeah, this is strange. It's an analog to digital. An analog digital converter has a digital to analog converter in it, and that is true. A digital analog converter will take a register, read a digital number, and here goes another bloody car along here. Reads on this one, it's making a heap of noise. Just listen to this one come across. It would be weird if it stopped up at the top of the hill. It's dangerous as all hell, these cars. No, look, I'm in the wrong. This is a one-way road down to Emu Plains. Are they coming up? Gee. I hope you heard that. Okay, so it's called a serial approximation, a sequential approximation register, a SAR. So let's go. We've got a sample on hold, and we've got a SAR register, and the SAR goes to a digital to analog signal. So the SAR gets read, put into digital analog. That then goes to the comparator, and the comparator says basically, you've done the right thing, you've done the wrong thing. One is good, so if it puts out a one, the one stays there. So essentially, the one will stay there. If it's not, it says, wipe that one off. Mate, it's no good. Then it goes back, and this is all clock ticked. But next time it says, okay. The next least significant bit, is it, and read it, is it bigger or less? It's less. Oh, so it's bigger than it. So that's okay, leave that there. And it does that there, in this case, 16 times, really, really quickly. And once it's done that, it on the last one, it goes, bugger me. And then what it does is it then broadcasts the information by, and so it is now read. Now, the SARS to A to D is not is parallel. So each it has to be quick. It is parallel. Parallel is a lot faster. Then it's read out in series. So it what it does is it goes the first 50 microseconds is the first bit. The second 50 microseconds is the second bit. And so it's you get the ones and the zeros going through. Now, I think, I'm not quite sure. Basically, it goes through and taps out the signal to come out. And so your signal goes out, at which it erases. And then, now you can imagine all these little components happening together. Now, what, of course, it... does you could well imagine that for all of this you could have some duplication that it's but I don't know if it ever does here. So it's whilst it's can be holding one, sampling another, and just toggling between the two, switching between the two, it may not be necessary. I'll tell you what, basically a valley here, and of course what happens is there's no cloud cover, so the air cools down a lot here, and then it's absolutely ripping through. Not my coat, I've got two coats, scarf, a beanie on, but it's ripping through. I've got two sets of tracking decks on, and it's just ripping through it. So I'm naked at the moment, in terms of it's so cold. So that's the overall process here. I've got all those components going together, and it's thank goodness you wouldn't want to be doing it yourself. You'd want a piece of electronics to do it. So it's a whole class activity to get one digital stuff. It's going out there now. Oh, there's a fantastic view here. So it's absolutely clear. For some reason, there's no mist. You can see right to the horizon going out here, and it's absolutely ripping me to shreds. It's so cold here. Okay, so the issue is that it's not easy. It is a bit hard. There's nothing, no really rocket science to it. It's not illogical. It is actually digital logic. It is applying a basic logic, and it is basically a little bit of computer to it. It's a computer program. A little computer is actually right up there. As it previously used to be a full computer, used to do this, and eventually more and more it's sort of, so the actual, what we think of CPU is getting a bit more refined. A CPU is something that we want to write programs to. Now, the A2D I've described to you is programmable. You can write program messages to it. You can program how it operates, because these A2Ds are so small. You have a little farm of them, a little four farm of them, and you tell them to switch. So it's very close on being programmable. So what's sort of happened is that as our computers have become more powerful, we in the 1950s said, "Oh, this is a computer," or we would have assigned it to a computer to do, and we sort of halved it off. It's sort of like this fuzzy edge of what makes a computer. Now, philosophically, I can tell you what actually does happen. You know, philosophically, teachers come up with an excuse for not explaining it. And at the end of the day, they will listen to what you say, and you say, "Well, do you think it's this, and that?" Yes. Oh, I knew that all the way. Or do you think it's that? And then honestly, that you're testing them, that they know or not. And then they change the topic, and possibly get angry. I don't know. Look, that's unfortunately that is. And they can prove that the kids don't need to know it by the circular logic. Now, what we're doing is we're sort of in the post-truth world, just trying to find some truth. Yeah. So the bottom line is that your digital thermometer that you put in your baby's mouth to read the temperature does A to D, and that's what it does. You know, I'm not making it up. It does all that complicated bit. So let's go through that. Sample and hold, SARS, D to A, comparator, write sequentially, write the SARS. When it's full, print it out. End of comparison. End of EOC. Put it out, and that's what happens. It's no longer, what the people used to do is they used to take the thermometer out and you could see them shake it. The old days, they used to for some reason shake the thermometer and look at it under the light. Nowadays they can do it. Now what obviously happens now is that you add a little bit of Bluetooth to it and you've got a thermometer on, and you can tell if your patient's overheating or. And basically, nowadays, the nurse sits there at a cardiac ward. There's a wall of screens, and she's just looking at every heart ticking over. Oh, that one's going a bit high. We'll just go up and see what that person's there. That person's a bit restless. They must be waking up now. Go out and go and check on that person. That type of stuff. So it's what it is, the real world. Now, however, we have to do one other thing. We have described this thing, which is impossibly large. We have to tell people the next secret about how, honey, I shrunk the circuit. How did I shrink a circuit? And how did I make the circuit so well? It's almost so, it's like a pamphlet. In fact, that's where we did. We probably did in two steps. One is the printing revolution. So I have the same information, the same instructions, the same rate notices, and I print it out and I feed it to the entire army or whatever it is, and everyone does the same thing. That's the idea of printing. And this is where the printing press, so one person got the same idea, could now print it out. Oh, one of the things that sort of gets to me about printing, so it's just this chilling feeling is the Japanese coming up, going in their boats from Formosa around up there, around in China, in their war boats, were given to invade Malaya, were all given a little pamphlet of how to be culturally sensitive and how to beat Australians. And it was given to the entire Japanese army, and they were there with their horses and everything, their transport boats, sort of coming down there reading this. And so this person got this pamphlet and printed it and gave it to the entire Japanese army. That's sort of this one thing in my head, which about printing. So the printing has got the fundamental thing is that you've got a piece of paper and some ink, and you put the ink on the piece of paper. Now, we're using it on the idea that ink bounces light off the paper, so that paper looks different. Now, what we're doing is that we came up with printed circuit boards, PCBs, printed circuit boards. And essentially, our ink was a conductive ink. So where we printed, the electrons would then actually follow across. So it's not printing where the image comes up to our face. Printing is sort of like your maze, where your finger traces along a line. Electrons trace a line. And then, I sit on top of that, components, and that's what they used to do. Your PCB board is essentially would have photo resist on it. It would be photographed, and then acid would etch the metal away, and you'd see tracks left. And so essentially, where you had dark, the photoresist would stay, and the photoresist would stop the acid. Acid would go down, and then people would drill holes for the thing, and then plug it, and then solder it, and then you've got just a circuit. Now, nowadays, I haven't seen one of these circuits for yonks, because doing it once is like how 1970s. Well, the only place I do see it is in school projects, where they do it, they don't know where they get this out of the eye. But nowadays they have basically this a whole book of these things, insulated layers and drills through, and it just works its way through a three-dimensional plot. So you get these small little boards with it. Now, the thing is that we then moved to silicon. Silicon, unlike having copper, which you etched away, a great conductor, and it, so the copper got etched away, leaving insulations around the place. This way here, we have silicon. And silicon's got several lots and lots of different qualities from it. Now, the silicon has got these just heaps and heaps of properties on it. But the main thing is that silicon is an insulator. How is it an insulator? Well, essentially, it's this is a crystal of silicon. A crystal of silicon has got a periodic array of atoms, and this is where you have to start. The electron, as described at school, is incorrect. The electron is not smaller than the nucleus. The atom is not mostly empty space. The electron is actually bigger than the nucleus. The electron actually permeates through space, and the electron has a fold into it, and the more energetic it gets, the more folded it gets. This is true. So the least energetic electron in a metal is just a blob. A slightly more energetic one has one folded, two folds in it, three folds in it, and so the folds keep on going up. Now, there is a certain point at which the folds match the crystal spacing between the little protons, the little whatever they are, the little nuclei, which are sitting out there in space. It matches it. And when it matches it, it does this funny thing. These are positive charges, these are negative charges. It matches. The positive and negative charges line up, and the energy drops for it. And then if I have a slightly bit more energetic one, the next energetic one, it doesn't match up. It's sort of like, I don't know, if you've ever... I think the sort of closest you can feel, if you get a fridge magnet, you can feel, you put two fridge magnets together, you can feel them ripple apart. So at a particular angle, it becomes extremely unfavorable. And this creates what's known as a band gap. Now, normally this doesn't matter. Now, the next thing you have to do is to say that there is this piece of mathematics which says that each electron has to be different. Therefore, to be different, it's got to have a little bit more energy. Each one I put in there has a little bit more energy. And so what happens is that you fill up all the electron possibilities up to this band gap, and the next one up, the next one has to have a huge amount of energy added to it to reach there. That's called a band gap there. And that band gap, where the electron can't just promote an energy, it can't conduct, so it's a perfectly full band. Now, this is something I have to tell you, is that electrons slide through each other, and so for each electron, there's two electrons, spin up, spin down, go across it, and then this is just more an artifact of the way maths. We have a forward travelling electron and a backward travelling electron. So if I've got a metal, I can consider electrons travelling away from me backward. Those, I've got two identical electrons, one travelling forward, one backwards, of the same shape. And this means that on average, that electron is just sort of oscillating back and forth, not moving, back and forth. So essentially, your piece of metal, right, has electrons, they're not moving anywhere. You know, I've got a metal. A metal energy, the electrons just don't flow out the end, they stay inside there, and that means that there's an equal number of electrons going forward and backwards. Now, what happens if I take one electron, backward electron going out, away, I'm left with a forward going electron, and so current's travelling forward. It's a momentum. And so you really need to know a little bit of quantum mechanics to it. So again, kiddies, you probably can't go that way, but I think your teachers have an obligation to know this, or to know of the extent of it. That is, it's sort of like a campground. You're going to take them to a new ecological area. There's some cliffs there. You may not know about how to scale the cliffs, but you've got to know that the cliffs are there. You've got to read the map and know the hazard. You've got to do a risk assessment, and risk assessment is that you can't be stupid. In fact, the risk assessment is that if you're stupid, you are the risk. You are a risk to their education. Not going across. Now, what you can do is that you can, and I think the best way I could say is flavour the silicon with a dopant, and the dopant is typically boron or potassium. What boron does, there's sort of certain ways that you can look at it. What it does is a boron changes the frequency spacing of the crystal structure, and creates an energy level just into the band gap. So there's an electron there, an electron gap, an energy state just into the band gap. Because there's just a little energy state there, electrons there can actually move up. So the holes actually sit up into the band gap, little bit up, and an electron can, with a little bit of energy, go into that band gap. And now there's a misconception here, unfortunately I have to go into it, that holes move inside the band gap. Now a hole in a band gap, that representation, because it is a representation of velocity space, says that the electrons have an unbalanced velocity. It's going forward. That hole does not have to move anywhere. I don't know where this comes from or why these people are somewhere. I see this. People are here as I'm walking through. Oh. You can see them walking up. So, the bottom line is that you can flavor silicon. Now, how do you flavor silicon? Well, there's a few zany ways of doing it, but in general, it's the same way you would flavor a roast. That is, you use heat for the flavour to diffuse into the silicon. That is, you put something with a bit of extra boron in it, and you heat the bejesus out of it. And when it heats up, the boron will diffuse into the silicon, just like garlic diffuses into a roast, or rosemary diffuses into a roast, goes in. And so That way you can actually write your conductor into the silicon. And the way you do that is that you have photoresist, and what you can do is you can actually fire the actual boron or phosphorus at the actual silicon, and then heat the bejesus out of it, let it diffuse. Or now there's a few more steps more. Previously, when I printed a circuit, I could only print where the conductors go. Now, because I can put two different types of silicon conductors together, a P and N type together, I can make a diode, I can make a transistor, I can make a field effect transistor, I can make heaps of switches, I can do something else. I can actually put an insulator between two plates. I can make capacitors on. I can do heaps of things. I can actually, if I want to, I can actually dig channels in my silicon. Now, the thing about it is that, unlike, you know, if I threw acid at your face, it would just eat your face away in every direction. But with silicon, part of because it's a crystal, because the crystal's aligned, if I line it up straight, the acid will etch down, and not left or right, it'll etch a perfect square ditch in it. And then I can spray it with copper, and I can lay copper on my stuff. Now, get this ready for you. In your classic computer chip, nowadays, they do this. They cut trenches, they spray it. Now, this is so hard to do. I'll explain a little bit more. But this will give you an idea. Because it's shrunk everything in your chip, your computer chip, which is less than the size of your little fingernail. This is your big laptop computer chip. And I'll talk about that a bit later. That one, so the one that you've got doing your A to D is like a nothing of a thump of a nothing. That your chip there has over a kilometre worth of copper cabling in it. Copper cabling is extremely fine, it's only a few atoms thick, but it's got a kilometre thick of this copper cabling in it. And this is, you know, that's mind-blowingly complex and distance. So we've basically got a photographic technique. And essentially, what's done is basically computers have been designing computers, and then computers have been running the processes which makes computers, and essentially you can get a multi-billion-dollar factory in this huge clean room. And basically, sorry, there's a few things glowing in the dark around here. And then you can actually just run it all through. And basically, you've got engineers and scientists and statisticians, and you can produce these wafers. So essentially, you need a single crystal of silicon. So let's start off where that happens. You get a single crystal of silicon, and you put it in a huge vat of molten silicon, and let the silicon cool down ever so slowly, and then the silicon will form crystallized like a snow crystal, huge crystal, and you pull it out of there ever so slowly, and then you have basically, you can pull out a multi-ton ingot, single crystal of silicon, pulled out of this vat, heated vat, enormously hot in these environments apparently, and then you got this crystal. Now, What you can do is another thing. Well, there's ways that you can make incredibly pure silicon. So silicon is SSI. You can get SH4, equivalent of methane, sealane gas, and you can run that through, you can purify that gas so it's really incredibly pure, run it through heaps and heaps of times, and then burn the gas and be left off with pure silicon, absolutely pure silicon. And there's other things that once you've got your silicon, you can still have a few atoms in your silicon, but then you can have a thermal gradient and your impurities will run to the surface. You just scrape it off. So it's pretty amazing stuff. So you can make very pure silicon. And say if you have an impurity, that impurity may affect the performance. So there's a wallaby beside me that may affect the performance of one in a million chips. And fortunately, you test all of them and pick it out. And so your impurities go there. Now, you then have to make a very, very small pitcher. So essentially, this has come from World War II, making microfilms. People wanted to store more and more visual data in a more compact form. This is for making spy cameras and stuff like that. And so they began to make better optics, films with smaller features, small crystals. And so essentially you could photograph invasion plans from the Reichstag and reduce it to a full stop in terms of magnification. And then once that microfilm was smuggled out, it could be expanded out. How much that ever did happen, I really don't know. And then there are ways of photographing it. So you bring in photograph after photograph, resist, photoresist, remove the photoresist, then lay down, down things, and you can build this up. And you can build quite an impressive amount of things. And now your transistor count, I think it's now standard 8 cores, 8 separate CPU units, and something like 10 billion resistors. So that's 10,000 million resistors. That's our resistors, transistors, switches here. So this has come across. Now, a long time ago, so there's a lot of research getting transistors small. So it's, you have to get them small because you've got to fit more of them in an area. You don't have to do that in an A to D. An A to D is already unbelievable. So the thermometer, what you're measuring, is already unbelievably large. So what we'll be doing is the ability to add a little bit of computing power up there, a little bit of redundancy, get things going in parallel. I don't know. Whereas the computers you hear about are, Formula One. These are family sedan cars with cup holders. In terms of their fairly large chips, and essentially if you make an A to D half the size, it's going to have very little effect on its it's very little effect on its performance because it's already in a fairly big package and all that type of stuff. Now this ability to flavour the silicon, etch the silicon, is something which is important to bring forward to the next stage of understanding, which is micro-electromechanical systems, MEMS machine. This is where you've actually carved your silicon up such that your digging in has actually created a little miniature machine. Now, the advantage of miniaturization is that you can actually produce millions of these on a wafer. Well, I'm not joking. This is 1,000 by 1,000 easily would fit in a wafer. Now, they're actually a bit bigger because they have sort of solder points for the things to hit, but the MEMS and the actual circuit is incredibly small. I suppose the other aspect of it is that once you get there, they're all made, and what happens is that it's like a brownie. You have to cut it up. A sort of diamond saw comes across, and essentially, in the waveform, a robot comes along with connectors and tests. Well, it may test everyone. It tests, say, every hundredth one, and it tests it in such a way that it's not pass-fail. It's performance. It really tests the performance of it, and so it can actually do it. Now, if there is a problem, they're more interested in, okay, we're producing them at a certain rate. In the pre-production they produce them and they detect error, and the main thing is they ruthlessly make the process pretty well damn perfect, so that they might produce one every couple of hours and flow through, and then once it's produced and they've got eliminated, got the error rate from 80% efficiency, 90% efficiency, 99% efficient, they can get the errors down, and then they hit the crank the handle and hit it forward. Now the bottom line is that once they've eliminated the error for one design, that error is not going to suddenly crop up with the next design. So you have all these these chips and things like this. And I suppose the issue here, the competitiveness, is the current drawing of these things and other functions. The lifetime is effectively I suppose basically infinite, simply because an example of a silicon thing failing is, say, an LED light bulb. Well, that's got huge amounts of power put through it. So your LED has, you know, a huge lifetime compared to anything that you know normally. Going forward now, these systems as well will be able to actually say if there's a fault, detect a fault, and go through it. So this is getting back to the A to D. The A to D is really a two-part story. A, analog to digital, it's A to D. I think it's ADC is the official name for it. A2D is the sort of like the folk or informal name for them. So A2D has probably three layers of understanding. The first layer is to know what a signal is, an analog signal and a digital signal, why you want it. The second layer is how mechanically it copes, you know, why you want it. The second question is how does it do it? And it does it by pretty well brute force. It looks like there's someone with a bike coming up here. Yeah, it's almost, it looks like a car driving up here. No? It's a, this is a bike coming along here. Pretty spooky at night. Come along. It's how it's done. It's pretty amazing, these lights. So it's how it does it. And then... G'day.
Hi.
It's pretty amazing. So why you do it, how it does it, and how... And the second one is how it's made. I think those come together, and then you see, you have an appreciation for just how many sensors you can put in a place, and you start thinking like a digital native. You start thinking, well, here's a beaker. I'm boiling it. I can measure the temperature, or I can own the three-dimensional temperature characteristic of that, record it and store it digitally. This is the digitization process has to really cross that final frontier. So we've got the digital technology around the sensor. We've got to have the digital technology around the person to see user. And their job now is to be at the level of the management of that digital technology. Teaching someone how to measure a thermometer is not going to get them a job, because I can build a digital thermometer to do it. Teaching someone how to deploy digital thermometers and react from it, that's where the job is. That's where the positions are to the future. And really, your job is to actually stretch to the future. The future really isn't sitting around talking to other people and just hoping it's like the past. The future is really going out there. So that's the A to D stuff. Obviously, I've gone to this long podcast because I've got this long walk to do. Thanks a lot for listening, Michael. And I hope this is worthwhile.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.